Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Software Crafts podcast. I'm your host, João, and today with us we have Jason Rozov. Jason has a passion for building products and teams that scale. He believes teaching people to be better leaders is at the core of building anything great. As co-founder and CEO of Radical Candor, Jason helps teams and companies, large and small, building the best relationships of their careers and achieving amazing results. Prior to Radical Candor, Jason spent 7 years scaling Khan Academy from 4 people to 100 as both Chief People Officer and Chief Product Officer. Working with partners in partnership with the Gates Foundation and Google, he helped Khan Academy improve educational outcomes for more than 100 million students and teachers worldwide. Previously, Jason was a product leader at Fog Creek, where he helped building the teams that created Stack Overflow and Trello. You might heard these names. Early in his career, Jason led engineering operations at a white label producer of photo books for Apple. He earned undergraduate and graduate degrees in management from New York University. Welcome to the show, Jason, and thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for inviting me on. I'm excited to be here and to chat with you all today.
So jumping to today we don't bring a heuristic, we bring a pattern, and it's personalized relationships for co-creation. What is your experience in personalized relationships for co-creation, Jason?
So when I read the pattern that you shared with me, the first thing that came to mind is the connection between close personal relationships and a feeling of safety. When we connect with each other at a human level, it makes it easier for us to be vulnerable and to share ideas. And so there's corollary research that Amy Edmondson has done in and around psychological safety, which is a term that people may have heard. But fundamentally, psychological safety, the outcome is that people feel safe to share ideas that might be very different than the ideas that everyone else is having, without fear of sort of reprisal or judgment for sharing something that's very out of the box. And from my perspective, if the goal is innovation, if the goal is to come up with something new that hasn't been thought of before, it has to start with that foundation of strong, custom, purpose fit relationships for that project. Because without that, it's very unlikely that people will feel safe actually sharing ideas that are very different.
Definitely. And I think that all of the work around psychology safety brought something to our industry, because back in the day we were just, well, the people that typey and something pops up, and it evolved, right? From CLIs and terminals, today we have beautiful immersive experiences, and that is great with people of all disciplines. And you talk about innovation, but innovation is also connected to complexity, right? So
yes,
what are we trying to tackle, right? Is this where you are edging towards?
Yeah, I think the pattern that you shared is sort of distinguishing the different needs if you're dealing with a sort of well understood problem versus a not well understood problem. In a well understood problem, you can follow the pattern that somebody else has created, right? You don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel, right? But often we confuse complex problems for simple or well understood problems. We look at a problem and we say, this looks very similar to the problem that somebody else faced. We're just going to follow the same pattern that they did. And an example of this is actually on the human side of organizations is how people structure benefits. So like the workplace benefits. So for example, you may have heard that organizations like Google provide free lunch for everyone.
Yep.
Well, that was an intentional decision to create social space around lunch. They didn't, when people didn't have this sort of free lunch, they were often going off campus and doing other things. And what Google wanted to do is they wanted to encourage people to stay on campus and to interact with one another. And so they offered free lunch. Well, the free lunch part got out into the sort of ether, and lots of other organizations started offering free lunch, but didn't know why they were doing it, right? And so Google was trying to solve a complex problem, which is we have all these people who interact with each other somewhat. We want to cross-pollinate, like across teams. We want people to have connection points across teams so that we're sharing ideas beyond the bounds of the people we work with immediately. What are some changes that we could make in the environment that would actually encourage that? And so they were solving this complex problem, but everybody else thought it was like, oh, this is just a benefit. This is just a way to attract people to working at our organization. So in order to be competitive with Google, we also have to offer free lunch because the value of what we're offering is the free and the food. And so it actually caused people to make logical errors by looking at they looked at Google's solution to a complex problem. They thought, this is great. It's like a new benefit that we can offer people. And so they copied it without really understanding what it was that they were doing. Another example of this is that Apple intentionally makes there be a walk to their restrooms inside their buildings. And the same idea here is like, they want you to walk through other spaces as you go to use the restroom. Now, there are some problems with that for like people with disabilities and stuff. So I'm not saying that that's a perfect solution. But again, like this is a very complex problem, which is like, how do you encourage let's say casual social interaction in an environment that actively discourages it, because you know both of those organizations are pretty famous for people working pretty hard, and that means sort of heads down and focused. And they were like, well, we need a way to broaden that out. And I think from my perspective, the sort of like mistake that people make of like looking at solutions to complex problems and thinking that they are patterns that they can follow in order to solve the same thing in their organization is hamstrings a lot of organizational thinking. And I think it applies to software development as well. Like, you know, it's one thing to, you know, understand why a lean or agile software development process might be helpful, like what it actually does to help solve complex problems. And it's another thing to implement it with no sense of the problem that you're solving, like the problem that you're trying to solve. And I see lots of companies doing that.
Definitely. I had this discussion 2 years ago. Yes, pre-COVID. I was in a customer and they were talking about bringing Spotify model and having open spaces. Okay, so first of all, Spotify didn't implement Spotify model. It was a very well-written blog post. But actually, you know that the secret of Spotify having team rooms, and adjacent to the team rooms, there is a space, creative space, which means that they don't have actually open spaces. They and that costs lots of money because you need lots of space.
Yep.
And people start thinking that the model itself is not just how do we put the reporting lines or how do we call to this role, but actually embracing everything. And I see, and this is interesting because you are on the other side of the world, how you experiment the same. People just taking a quick win just because Google or Apple does, the very famous companies, and doesn't work. You are CEO in a company, you advise other companies. Do you have the feeling that leaders are more aware of the complexity and especially the social relations that can bounce back here and there?
I think when I ask people to tell me stories about their organization, they tell me complex stories, right? They tell me stories of like complex relationships. But when we start to talk about solutions to problems that they have, they're driven to try to try to simplify the problem, to abstract away the complexity, and come up with a simple solution to a very complicated, very complex, I don't want to use the wrong language, a very complex problem. And And even when they say, well, isn't it complicated, right? Like in the sort of lingo of complexity theory, right? Isn't it complicated where we can actually understand both the impact of the inputs on the outputs? But when I break it down for them, they start to see, oh, actually, no, like we can't really predict, like, even though like there's lots of operators and we sort of are aware of other operators, what I'm saying is like, there are operators that you are completely unaware of. Like you have no idea, like there's something that's going to happen after you start this process that we have not predicted at all. And we need a way to deal with that. And that, I think, throws them for a loop. In fact, I feel like we've lost some sales because when I try to break it down for people of like, you know, I know what you're trying to do, but I want to make sure that I'm setting expectations correctly, that you see it as we have this problem where people aren't giving enough feedback, for example. We want to train people on how to give feedback better. And we expect that when the training is complete, people will be giving more feedback in a better way. And what I'm saying is, what I'm trying to explain to them is like, actually, that's not the problem, right? I don't think giving feedback is that hard. And so training people on the skill of giving feedback is helpful, but it's very unlikely to actually produce the result that you're looking for. And so the question is, what is stop? So like you have really high quality feedback training and people still aren't giving feedback to one another, or they're not doing it very well. So like, what is the problem, right? The problem is hidden. It's complex. And we don't actually know what all of the interlocking elements are. We can make some educated guesses as to like, it might be about relationships. It might be about sort of culture and expectations in the organization. It might be about personal sort of comfort development, like sort of cognitive and emotional development that people like, there's lots of possibilities, but none of those are simple. Like not accessing or addressing each of those things is not simple. And so the question is, how do we create a process to address this question such that we can try things and start to understand the impact that they're having? And that is the point at which I think most CEO or executives' eyes glaze over, and they're just sort of like, well, I wanted to hire you to solve a problem for me. So if you're telling me that in order to solve this problem, I actually need to do a bunch of work, that's unappealing.
I can't imagine.
And I get it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. And I have a lot of empathy for them because like I fall into this trap also as a CEO, like, you know what I'm saying? Like I run into a complex problem in my own organization and I wish it was simpler. Like but wishing doesn't make it so, unfortunately.
And it's always like that in our own organizations. We think, okay, this might not happen. And bam, we are on that trap. But it's very interesting because I think that what you are referring here, and this is a thing that I'm trying to get my thought around, and also talk with other people, is the ability to read weak signals. Right? And what I feel is that, let's talk about executives, especially in organizations that have more than 500 people. I don't see lots of practices to read weak signals from their own organization. Mm-hmm. And that causes them problems, right? Because with more than 500 people, you are not connected to all operational work. You don't see. So you have lots of proxies. And I don't see these practices. We can call them feedback, but also I call them picking up weak signals. Are people talking enough in a, you know, in Slack or Teams or whatever tool that are, right? And I don't see this ability. Do you share the same opinion or do you see another way?
Yeah, I think people have the ability. Yeah, there's like a lot of sort of thoughts. I'm trying to organize them in my own head. Going back to the pattern that you shared, like I do think that relationships are a bulwark against missing weak signals. Right? Because the idea is like, as you strengthen the network, you create more nodes that are listening to more to other nodes. So as you strengthen the network, you increase the number of listeners, and you decrease the distance that information has to travel before it hits somebody else. And so I think in organizations where there are strong relationships, I actually think it's much more likely for weak signals to get boosted. But one of the things that executives struggle with is they are often very disconnected from the people whom they support, right? For the people that they lead in that organization. And that's, you know, the consequence of a million different factors, but a lot of it has to do with, like, as you said, in an organization of more than 500 people, you have a lot of specialization going on. And with specialization, you very easily can wind up in sort of silos, right? Where they're like different specializations are not really talking to each other. And then the organizational structure that supports that also adapts to that. So there's like a there's like a negative feedback loop, which is like, as you get specialization, you get more segregation of information. And as you get more segregation of information, the structure of the organization responds to support that. So, like, for example, maybe you have a marketing team, and then over time you decide, oh, we also need analytics. And at first, marketing and analytics are the same team and they report to the same person. But as you hire more and more specialists in analytics, at some point you say, oh, we need an analytics manager. And at first that analytics manager reports into the marketing person, but then you decide, well, that's not exactly right. And now we have requests from analytics from customer service, and we have requests from and all of a sudden you've got two teams, you've got marketing and analytics. And over through this process, there's less and less network connections between those two teams, meaning that there's less and less communication. And then when the separation happens, now you have a person who's taking whose job it is, whose fiduciary responsibility of the organization is to care for that analytics organization. And that creates this weird us and them, right? Now, all of a sudden, instead of we are the marketing team, we're the marketing or the analytics team. And the structure is now reinforcing, there are actually incentives to not share information, right? Because you might be able to get more for your organization if you control more of the information flow. And so that's what I mean by as we specialize, we actually it causes this negative feedback loop. And this has, from my perspective, has a lot to do with the minimal group theory in psychology, which is basically like human beings will form group identities based on almost nothing instantaneously, and will start to prefer their group, their in-group versus and disprefer an out-group. And as organizations grow, these problems manifest themselves in lots of different ways. And so by the time you get to that executive level in an organization with more than 500 people, there's all of these forces which are like discouraging you from listening to those weak signals, especially the ones outside of your immediate sort of scope of influence. And it causes huge problems. Because most of the interesting problems in organizations are not, like, sometimes they're within a vertical, like they're in the marketing organization. That's true. Almost all the time, the most interesting problems in an organization are at the seams between teams. And there's no one whose responsibility it is in most organizations to care about that explicitly, right? There's no one who's tell me the title of the person whose job it is, other than maybe COO, whose job it is to care about the seams between functional teams or between product teams in an organization. There's no one. In most organizations, the structure does not have a person responsible for that. And yet when I talk to companies, everybody says, well, I can see how I can give feedback within my own organization, but what if it's someone I'm on a team with marketing and customer service, and like, what if I had to give feedback to someone on that? That seems really awkward. So the people are aware of it. You know what I'm saying? Emotionally, people are aware that these separations exist, even though they're not sure how to solve it.
And I think that you are touching, because this is what ticks with me, right? I'm specializing and reading more and more with social technical systems, especially. So I'm a consultant helping companies with this, but I also take interim roles in a way that, okay, I'm CTO of this company, I'm going to help you transform rather than be on the sideline. And this is what I tell to people. We are organizing domains, and we have a very specific interface. And this problem that you are talking about, it's what I call, we need to have intentional decisions. We're going to start, this analytics team with marketing, but until some point, this analytics team will be a platform, right? So we're going to cut some ties. It's fine, but then we'll serve the organization. And this is exactly the point. I think the only way that we know is that things grow organically, because we don't know any other form of growing, right?
Yeah.
We are carbon-based. But then we are not intentional. We are not saying, okay, if we grow over, let's talk about Dunbar's number, 15 and then 25 and then 100, it's unmanageable, right? So how can we do this? So we don't look to flow in one way, nor the complexity, what we are creating inside of our organizations, right? Because you start with innovation. And this is what I love. That analytics team with marketing was innovation for marketing. And the potential was amazing to the company. That company said, oh, now we need analytics everywhere, which is true. But now analytics needs more body, more business capabilities, more people, more. And they totally forget about relationships. About, in the end, it's about people. And totally forget about this. So it's very, very interesting how this goes. So, and I think that this is connected to a part. So the company that you lead calls Radical Candor, the book that Kim Scott wrote. And for me, the passage there that really touched me and I keep with me is that make your values actionable. Right? Lots of companies have the values and then they are not actionable. I actually was seeing a company today called Buffer that they even have the salaries post online, because their value is transparency. So having the salaries online of the people is the transparency. How do you help companies walk the talk, right? Be actionable with their values?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we talk about when we talk about often radical candor is being brought in to help breathe life into a value in a company. So in fact, like I think this is one of the places where I feel like people, there's enough discipline in the world that, at least in the customers who are likely to reach out to us, that they're sending out surveys to people to try to understand their experience of being a part of the organization. And one of the things that they get back consistently is there are some places which we are not walking the talk, right? We're saying one thing and we're doing another. And communicating with transparency and candor is one of those places where I think a lot of organizations get feedback like, hey, we're not actually living up. Like we say we want to do this, but we're not actually living up to it. And so that's the state at which we get brought in to a lot of companies. It's like they've reached that level of awareness. But the way that I like to think about this is that your culture is not, your values are not what is written down, right? Your values are in the experience of the team members. It's in every interaction that team members have. And this is why there's no such thing as a monolithic set of values or a monolithic culture in any organization. Like you go into an organization that's large enough, and not only are there cultures across sort of like functions or divisions, but there are cultures there are different cultures across different teams within a function. And the question is like, how does this happen? And my point is like, it happens naturally. Like when it is unclear how to live the values that you espouse, when it's unclear what it even looks like, forget like instruction manual. What is it? What's a good example of living this value? When you don't even have that level of clarity, you know, it's open to a lot of interpretation, and that causes a sort of quality control problem, right? Which is like, now you have this disconnect between, what I know to be true is that people are very sensitive to this. Like people are very sensitive to a disconnect between written values and lived experience. And they can notice even subtle differences. But for example, there are a lot of companies that have adopted the no jerk rule. Like we don't hire jerks here. But when you go inside those companies and you see, like you ask people, they're like, well, that's not exactly true. And not only do we hire some jerks, we like promote them to executive leadership. And so the people in that organization respond to that intuitively, right? They're not necessarily, it's not at the level of cognition, but at the level, at the subconscious level, they're like, this doesn't really mean anything. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to take this seriously. And so usually what I say to organizations when they say, hey, we've got this disconnect is like, one, you have to acknowledge that the disconnect exists. If you can't talk about the fact that there's a difference between what we're saying and what we're doing, like, you're sunk. You have zero chance of making any change. So first step is acknowledging that you have the problem and doing that very clearly. And I think the second step is not to like institute change, but instead to hear from people, like, what are you seeing today, right? What is your experience today? Like, I want to understand what it's actually like, or how you perceive the way that we sort of act on or respond to our values. And then before you worry about implementing a bunch of programmatic or sort of procedural changes to support the culture change, I think it's really important to take a moment once you've done that to say, how important is it to you, our team, that we uphold this value? Like, is this value actually critical? Because the other thing that I've noticed is that because there's no real cost to having values, because most organizations are doing no work to support them, organizations tend to have a lot of them. There's usually like 10 values and then sub bullet points underneath each of those 10 values. But there are values that are more important than others. And so before you go changing stuff, like saying, how important, like, is this as important as our other values? Or would you like, is it more important that we uphold something else that we're doing? And then at that point, I think you can start talking about solutions. Like, once you've gotten the green light, like, actually, this is really important to us. Transparency really matters. And then I think the really interesting thing that happens next is, like, as you start to figure out ways that you can uphold the value of transparency, you are going to make people uncomfortable. And the reason why is because that value is an abstraction. And until you turn it into action, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, transparency means, you know, that we are aware of what happens at board meetings, for example, or we're aware of the strategic decisions that our leadership team is making. I don't think a lot of people would assume that transparency means posting salaries on the internet. Like, that would not be the automatic assumption. And so as you clarify your values, as you turn them into action, you're actually going to alienate some people. And that has to be acceptable. Like, if you really want to action your values, you have to recognize that this is not going to be an everybody's happy moment. This is going to be, we're going to make some people pretty annoyed, actually.
Yeah, definitely. But that is the work of a leader, right? Yeah. You have a company, you have a purpose and a mission, right? And you have a scope, you have your values to anchor. And when you start leaving them, some people will say, well, it's not for me, which is fair, right?
Absolutely fair.
How Kim starts the book. Well, I was not fair with that person that I manage and then end up bad.
Yeah.
But that's the point, right? The interview process is to catch these, but sometimes doesn't catch and we cannot work together. Well, luckily for us, in these latitudes of the world, we are privileged to have enough work. We cannot complain
yes.
about that, right?
So yeah, we have that privilege. Absolutely right.
Yeah, cool. So picking up your brain almost one of the last times, what are your wishes to our industry, you know, people that create software and digital solutions?
Well, having been a member of that industry for most of my career, I will say, like, the one thing that has been most heartening to me, the pattern, the shift that I've seen, is really the shift toward like user-centered problem solving. So I think if you will allow me a momentary sort of philosophical rant about technology. I think one of the biggest losses of the last several decades is if you look at science fiction from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, all of it is about how technology is going to make life better. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're going to improve the human condition through technology. And unfortunately, like, I think where we've wound up is, yes, that is absolutely true. In many ways, we have improved the human condition, and like, there's lots of really positive things that have happened. But I also think there's a lot of we're living with a lot of unintended consequences. And a big part of the reason why we wound up that way was because we weren't actually, we didn't care that much about the consequences. And that's because there was a disconnect between like the people making the stuff and the people using the stuff. And as that gap has closed, I think we become more aware of the impact that our choices are making. And I think that's a really, really powerful pattern. And that's something that I would like to see continue, is like that gap gets smaller and smaller, to the point where at Khan Academy, we would have like co-creation sessions where we'd bring teachers and students in and we'd actually work with them to think, to like brainstorm and think about what would we build or how would we do this. And it was in those moments that I think, you know, we really began to understand the power of, you know, the sort of knowledge and awareness of each of the, you know, an individual user on the way and the influence that could have on the way that we thought about things. So that's like, my pitch is like, if you feel like your developers, your engineers are at arm's length from your customers, like you should be doing everything you can to shorten that gap, like to shorten that distance. We don't want to have informational intermediaries either. Like the product manager who has all of the user knowledge is like, that's a huge waste. Like we want to close the gap as much as possible between the people who have fingers on keyboard and like the actual experience out in the world. Because I do believe that that's how we've, you know, had, you know, algorithmic bias, for example, you know, when we do facial recognition software and we realize that it incorrectly identifies, you know, black and brown faces a much higher percentage of the time than it does white faces. And the question is like, well, okay, so like, how did that happen? How did it not occur to the engineers that this bias might exist? And I think in part it's because there's an abstraction, there's too much abstraction between creating the solution and really understanding the problem and the people that it's going to affect, like having the consciousness of the people that it's going to affect. That's not the entire solution, but I think it's a big part of it. So that's like thing number one. It's like, just engineers should not, like I engineers are people too. And I know that they care about the things that are happening to their end users, and organizations should really support that, should lean into that, as opposed to a lot of companies are, you know, moving the other direction. They're like, we need to protect our engineers. Like they can't be distracted by the stuff that's happening with end users. And I'd love to see that continue to get better.
Thanks. I think that we are getting there one step at a time.
Yeah.
Last question of this episode. What are the resources that you recommend to the audience?
Well, Radical Candor is a great resource. It's a great book. I think one of the I'm extrapolating. You didn't actually say this to me, but I would guess that one of the reasons why you enjoyed Radical Candor is the same reason that I enjoyed it, which is like organizes a set of things that feel sort of like amorphous and disconnected, which is like what goes wrong in these sort of one-to-one conversations. Like it organizes thinking around that and it gives you a model to think about, okay, these are the types of problems that appear in these conversations and here's a way that we can start to address them. And I think that like you definitely said this earlier in the podcast, which is just like, the majority of interesting problems are really about people. And so I think we need to build some more awareness of that. So Radical Candor is great for that. There are some other books that have inspired me over time. Liz Wiseman wrote this book called Multipliers. And there's this really interesting section in Multipliers about detractors, essentially, like what are some of the patterns that's like, what I love about that section is like, what are the well-intentioned things that we do that actually wind up harming the individuals on our team, either their ability to collaborate effectively or their ability to achieve success. And my negative pattern is like, I have like a sort of parental streak, a protective mama bear type of attitude towards my team. And sometimes that actually gets in the way of me giving them challenging assignments that will actually help them stretch and grow. So that was that's another place that I've looked that I think does another good job of organizing some thinking that feels very complicated and makes it a little bit more accessible to start thinking about it. I guess I would say last but not least, I want to give a shout out. Based on this conversation, I would guess that people in your audience would also enjoy this podcast called You Are Not So Smart. And You Are Not So Smart is basically it's about human psychology and is focused on why we think the things that we think. And I think for me, they've done some work recently on some episodes on narcissism and minimal group theory and these other things that are really helping me start to unpack some of the experiences I'm having as a human with other humans in the world. So those three resources, couldn't recommend highly enough.
All right, thanks. And it's always good to have these resources that unpack this previous experience so we can put them in some quadrant, whatever is the model.
That's right.
And with this, I want to once again, thanks for your time to be here with us.
My pleasure.
You can follow us on Twitter at @SCraftsPodcast. Visit our website, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or visit our page on LinkedIn. To get to you next week.